Hands of My Podcast is a proud member of Darkcast Network, presenting the brightest of indie podcasts.
The Missing Magnolias podcast tells the stories of the missing and murdered.
Ultimately, these kids went into state custody and they never came out.
Together with missing persons expert Dr. Michelle Janisse, we uncover the real true crime experience.
Every time we do another interview, I'm like, how do we find so many badass women?
We hear from victims who turn their pain into something positive.
We didn't find out till we were 11 or 12 years old that our mom was murdered.
In Times Square, it said Mickey Shunick fought for her life.
And experts who think outside the box to solve cases.
I scour missing persons databases like NamUs to see if they're uploaded to that database.
Subscribe to Missing Magnolias on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts today.
Hey, this is a true crime podcast. I talk about murder. I talk about sex. I talk about a lot of things that young people shouldn't hear. Maybe adults shouldn't either, because I tend to swear some. Listen at your own discretion. Hey there, Rainbow Warriors. Welcome to Beyond the Rainbow, True Crimes of the LGBTQ+. I'm your fabulous friend and host, CJ. So, as some of you know, I've been dog-sitting again for my neighbors. It was 10 days this time while they went on vacation. I decided to wait until the dogs went home today to record this. That way I didn't have to edit out any barks and any of my shut the fuck up. I really love those dogs, but 10 days was a lot. Anyway, I survived in spite of all the extra gray hairs. Find me on the socials as Rainbow Crimes and Darkcast Network, just about everywhere. Please consider joining my Patreon, where I have a stable full of unicorns just waiting for you to claim one. You'll also receive ad-free, early release episodes and an extra episode every month for only $5 each month. Also, if you provide your mailing address, I'll send you some extra goodies. I'll leave the link to Patreon in my show notes. Come see me at the end of August in Austin, Texas for the True Crime Paranormal Festival. You can get an idea of the cool shows that'll be there by visiting the website, and I'll leave a link to that as well in the show notes. Also, if you type in Beyond, B-E-Y-O-N-D, at checkout, you'll receive 15% off your tickets. Some of you might remember I covered the murder of DeAndre Matthews as a true crime quickie a few episodes back. Just a quick recap. DeAndre, who went by Dre, was a gay, black, 19-year-old man, and he asked to borrow his mom's Jeep because he loved to drive. Dre had two jobs and he went to school, but in his free time he was mostly a homebody, and he loved playing video games and spending time with his family. After borrowing his mom's Jeep one night in February of this year, 2023, he didn't show up back home. His mom's Jeep was found burnt not far from his home after she reported her son missing. Trey's body was found the following day near some railroad tracks in Flatbush, New York. Trey had a couple gunshot wounds, one to his head and one to his back. He was also set on fire. His mom said she didn't think he was seeing anyone. And I made the comment he was working two jobs and going to school. I thought it would be hard to see anyone with his busy schedule. Well, some good news towards justice in that case. Dre's alleged killer has been captured. And kudos to the police for actually searching Dre's phone. They found pictures of Dre along with another 19-year-old man named Isaiah Baez who lived in Flatbush. But there's been no confirmation about exactly what the relationship between the two young men was. Only speculations, as they seem to have known each other for a little over a year. Isaiah was arrested and he was charged with Dre's murder. Also, a 24-year-old man was arrested in connection for tampering with evidence. He's suspected of helping Isaiah dispose of Dre's body. I'll keep my ears open for any new developments in this case. Also, in the case of Ray Hainish that I covered way back in September 18, 2020, this was Season 3, Episode 10. There's finally been a little bit of movement now that that asshole prosecutor Robert Guy is no longer the DA of the county Ray was murdered in. I still keep in contact with Ray's mom Dottie and his sister Char on Facebook. Just as a reminder, Ray was murdered by a local thug named Garrett Kurtz, and this was in Indiana. Kurtz also had tortured and murdered a 30-year-old woman that he had been romantically involved with. Her name was Nicole Bowen. All of this happened the end of March 2019. Kurtz admitted to killing Ray in Ray's home. Then Kurtz continued to party in Ray's home with his group of thug friends. After Kurtz was arrested for Nicole's murder, he was accused of Ray's murder too. And even though Kurtz admitted to killing Ray, the prosecutor, Robert Guy, didn't want to touch Ray's case. Many believed it was because of Robert Guy being homophobic. Kurtz even said, "Oh yeah, I killed him. It was an accident during rough sex. I accidentally strangled him to death," which I have to tell you is complete and utter unicorn shit. Then Kurtz proceeded to steal Ray's car and other items as well. Kurtz received 55 years of incarceration for Nicole's murder. Let's hope he gets another 55 added on for Ray's. Ray's sister and mom just posted that killer Kurtz had a hearing already in Ray's murder. But the hearing was simply for Kurtz to request another attorney because his family couldn't afford the one they had. And this is just idiotic as hell. But the court said they'd pay for Kurt's attorney. To me, that's suspicious as fuck. Why would taxpayers' money go to an attorney for this asshole who's already been convicted of one murder? There's something called a public defender. Hey, they're free and for low-income people. Give the asshole Kurtz a public defender. What I want to know is why is this piece of shit so much more important than anyone else that the court is going to pay for his attorney? Okay, I just wanted to update you on those cases. So this man who works or worked for Fox News as a crime analyst, his name is Rod Wheeler. He went on to the Bill O'Reilly show, and I'm sure Bill was creaming his jeans with what Rod Wheeler was about to expose. No, it wasn't his penis. But what those two men did after the show, hey, that's their business. Rod was apparently doing a segment on ruthless black lesbian gangs that originated out of Tennessee called Dykes Taking Over. The origins of this gang and why they were even formed was to deal with homophobic bullying in an urban American school district. Well, that sounds reasonable to me. However, their way of handling their bullying experiences apparently was to turn it around on the bullies and do exactly the same thing their bullies were doing to them, fighting fire with fire, so to say. Well, that didn't go over so well. A series of alleged incidents of same-sex harassment by Dykes Taking Over that was forced on heterosexual students was used by these women to reestablish a power differential after they experienced bullying based on their sexuality and their gender expression. While I can appreciate the sentiment behind the group, their means and tactics sound like it was a really poor way to handle the situation. But going back to the Bill O'Reilly episode with Rod Wheeler, which aired in 2007, Rod tells Bill,
"Yes, Bill, in addition to carrying weapons and violently attacking people, these lesbian gangs are alleged to have raped girl victims they recruit. As a matter of fact, some of the kids have actually reported that they were actually forced into, you know, performing sex acts and doing sex acts with some of these people."
Rod goes on to tell Bill O'Reilly that there are even now gays taking over gangs out there. They sodomize their victims with sex toys. Rod and Bill, Can you just stop already? Although Bill O'Reilly had to apologize for the lies about a national epidemic of black lesbian gangs coming after female children, the story had nonetheless achieved the desired goal of infotaining its audience by perpetuating both frightening racist and homophobic stereotypes. I consider that to be media right-wing sensationalism at its finest. And even after that segment, Bill O'Reilly attributes murders with lesbians involved to the gang Dykes taking over. So, this case is actually about a young girl, a 15-year-old girl named Sakia Gunn. And while I was researching Sakia, that's how I stumbled upon this Fox News piece. And I didn't want to get too off topic while I'm telling you Sakia's story. So I thought I'd lead with the bullshit media that actually came up in an article about Sakia. May 11th, 2023 was like just last week or a week and a half ago. It was the 20-year anniversary of the murder of a 15-year-old black lesbian named Sakia Gunn. She was only 15 years old and she was murdered for living her truth. Now, I've had Sakia's case on my paper list and my dry erase board and even my website to cover for quite some time now. With the recent passing of the 20th anniversary of her death, now is the time. Wow, that means she'd be 35 years old today had she been given the opportunity to live out her life, and we have no idea what she might have become or what greatness she might have achieved. Her tale is another tragic story of homophobic hate at the hands of misogynistic men. Grown-ass men who thought it fitting to pick on and torment teenage girls, children, and ultimately murder one. Something else that is tragic in this case, in spite of Sakia's murder occurring nearly 5 years after Matthew Shepard's murder, Matthew's murder had over 650 articles written about it in a 7-month time span. Sakia's brutal killing only garnered about 25 articles total, and that was in the same time span, 7 months after her murder. So what does that say about mainstream media? It either says Sakia's murder wasn't gruesome enough for media outlets, or it says that a teenage black girl murdered wasn't important enough for them to cover. Possibly it's a little of both. Sakia was a masculine-presenting lesbian. And researching this case, I learned a new term. Or maybe it's a very outdated term I've never heard of for butch lesbians. It's two letters, A-G, and it stands for aggressive. Does that mean if a woman is masculine-presenting, they're automatically assumed to be aggressive? Does that mean all men who are masculine presenting are aggressive? I'm really not fond of that term, and I'm surely not aggressive. Assertive, maybe. A leader, definitely. But the word aggressive has total negative connotations to it. Sakia lived with her mom and her grandmother. She came out as a lesbian at the age of 11. She was a high school sophomore or grade 10, and she earned all straight A's. Sakia's love was basketball. She had dreams of playing professional basketball someday. The evening of May 11, 2003, Sakia and four of her female teenage friends, they took a bus into New York City's Greenwich Village from Newark, New Jersey. This was only about 13 miles away. In Greenwich Village, they could live their truths without judgment because of the large LGBTQ community in Greenwich Village. They visited the Christopher Street Pier, where a number of people just like them were known to hang out and socialize. It was an evening of fun with her friends and other like-minded people. The girls were dropped back off by a bus after 3 a.m., and then they were waiting for another bus that would transport them to their home. And as a mom, my first thought is, nope. But perhaps the parents and guardians of these girls thought, safety in numbers, and they all ventured out together before, they would be okay. Or perhaps, like many teenage girls, they each told their parents they were staying over another one's house. Nevertheless, the night was never supposed to head in the direction it did. While the girls waited for their connecting bus, a car, an old white station wagon with two men, 28-year-old Richard McCullough and his friend Alan Pierce, drove slowly near the girls. The men were whistling and catcalling at the young girls. Now, the girls tried to ignore the two men, and they even turned their backs to them. But not to be deterred, the men stopped their car, and they kept talking to the girls, encouraging them to come closer. They even propositioned them for sex. The girls announced, "No thanks, we're all lesbians." And for some reason, this pissed the men off. They got out of the car and started to approach the girls. Richard McCullough got physical, and he grabbed a girl and put her in a chokehold. That's when Sakia and her friend Valencia started to combat the men. They were hitting the men and trying to deflect their unwanted advances. Sakia was a petite girl, only 5'3 and 110 pounds. At that point, Richard McCullough pulled a knife and he lunged it in Sakia's chest. Sakia slumped to the ground as the two men got back into their car and they sped away. Quick-thinking Valencia saw another car stopped at a red light and she ran to it. She started pounding on the driver's side window. She was begging for the driver to help. The driver was a man and he agreed to help the girls. They loaded Sakia and Valencia into his vehicle and he drove to a hospital emergency room. But it was too late. Sakia died as Valencia was holding her. It's been surmised a lot of black straight men don't like masculine-presenting lesbians, mostly because their manhood is threatened, just like the men in South Africa who corrective rape women. They develop the attitude, "You're only gay because you haven't had a good dick in you yet." They feel by inserting their penis into the woman's vagina, the woman is miraculously going to say, "Oh, that's just what I needed. I'm no longer a lesbian. Let me go put on a dress and make you a sandwich." These men are straight-up criminals, rapists, and in this case of these teenage girls, they're pedophiles. These two men had no fucking business pulling up on these teenage girls. What the hell were they doing propositioning them in the first place? The girls weren't sex workers. They weren't coming on to the men. They were telling them no. The Newark police started looking for the old white station wagon. But within a few days, Richard McCullough and his attorney showed up at the police station on their own. Richard was turning himself in. The other man who was with Richard the night Sakia was killed, he was questioned. But he was quickly released and never charged with anything regarding that night. Not even harassment. Richard was arrested and charged with murder. Of course, a plea deal was offered to him, which he scooped up. Richard also claimed Sakia ran into his knife. All charges of murder were dropped. Richard now faced aggravated manslaughter, aggravated assault, and biased intimidation charges. His defense attorney argued that his client just simply made a mistake. First of all, Sakia did not just run into his knife. And why the fuck did he even draw a knife? Why did this limp dick asshole think it necessary to accost a group of teenage girls? Was his manhood that threatened and that pathetic? He couldn't find himself a woman his own age? Secondly, what Richard did wasn't simply a mistake. He took a child's life. I am so angry that he was offered a plea deal, and it was only for manslaughter. There were no real hate charge enhancements. Although the justice system thought that they were doing Sakia's family and the prosecution a big-ass favor with the biased intimidation charge tacked on. It was the closest thing to a hate crime enhancement that this case would ever see. Apparently, the biased intimidation charge was rarely ever seen in the New Jersey courts. Richard received a sentence of 20 years. He's out now on parole, and he's living his best life. which we can't say for Sakia. Over 2,500 people attended Sakia's funeral. It was open casket, and the young girl was laid to rest in a blue tracksuit. And although New Jersey politicians promised Sakia gun supporters they would erect a community center in Newark and name it in Sakia's honor, they never came through. But 10 years after Sakia's murder, the Unity Fellowship Church founded an LGBTQ+ center. And although it's not named for her, it has a huge mural around it with Sakia's face. While Sakia's case still hasn't received the same coverage as Matt Shepard's or even Brandon Tina's, it's received some from podcasters who help keep Sakia's memory alive, including one that I did get some information from called Your True Crime. There's also a documentary film that was made in 2008. It's called Dreams Deferred, the Sakia Gunn Film Project. It depicts the homophobic bias spurning Sakia's murder and the lack of media coverage after her death. The film reminds us that LGBTQ+ youth are often ignored or rejected, and even oftentimes the victim of a violent crime. Rest in power, Sakia. Our true crime quickie comes to us from Toronto, Canada. Not only was 2020 a shitty year because of COVID, but the life of 52-year-old Peter Eli was taken from the world. Peter was a disc jockey and video jockey, also known as a DJ-VJ. He did this in a couple hop-in Toronto nightclubs. One was called Woody's, and another one was Pegasus. His stage name was DJ Peter Blue. People who knew Peter said he was a sweetheart of a guy and the friendliest person you'd ever want to meet. We just passed the 3-year anniversary of Peter's murder as he was found in his apartment complex laundry room. It was in the early morning hours of May 14th, 2020. Peter's body was found by a fire crew responding to a fire in the laundry room of the complex. This was located near Yonge Street and Davisville Avenue. The crew was able to quickly put the fire out. Another resident said that they heard screaming and yelling, and then suddenly silence, and then a few thuds. She said she was about to call the police when the screaming stopped, but she became scared for her own well-being when the silence occurred. After that, she smelled smoke. Peter's roommate said Peter went down to the second floor laundry room to do, well, some laundry, but he never returned back to their apartment. The homicide division of the Toronto police were called, and within hours, they were examining film footage from the apartment building. On the video, they saw a possible suspect, and they released a clip of him to the public. The following day, a 27-year-old transient black man was arrested. He was charged with murdering Peter. There seemed to be no previous relationship between Peter and his alleged killer. Peter's autopsy suggested that he was bludgeoned to death before the fire was started. And since the two men didn't even seem to know each other, there's been no motive found in this case. The suspect that was arrested is named Rico, and as far as I can tell, there's been no resolution to Rico's court case. He has been charged with second-degree murder, but I haven't seen if he's gone to trial yet. Rest in power, Peter. I love you, Rainbow Warriors. You matter. Remember, it's not a crime to be gay, unless you're a murderer.